Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In nearly every account of the Tulsa Race Massacre, you'll read the words of Mary Jones Parrish. Parrish was a young woman who ran a secretarial school in Greenwood in 1921 and wrote one of the few contemporaneous accounts of her experience and others that has survived from the tragic events of May 31st and June 1st that year. But actually reading her account and the story she meticulously recorded from other survivors has been a rare experience. Copies of her book, Events of the Tulsa Disaster, a 1923 self-financed and published account, only number in a few dozen. In fact, when Parrish's great-granddaughter, Annalisa Bruner, received her family copy from her father, it was like a precious heirloom being passed to the next generation. And when she read it, well, Bruner experienced the same awakening that so many Tulsans and people around the country have experienced over the past 30 years about hearing about this event. Now, on the 100th anniversary of this tragic event, there's a new edition of this compelling account, The Nation Must Awake, My Witness to the Tulsa Race Massacre. It's published by Trinity University Press. Annalisa Bruner joins me to talk about this important book that has been a cornerstone in getting the truth of the massacre out. She'll be participating in a virtual book event Tuesday, May 25th at 7 o'clock with Magic City Books, and the following day she'll be a participant at the John Hope Franklin Center's Reconciliation Symposium. She'll be speaking Wednesday at 4. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Annalisa Bruner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I've read quotes from your great-grandmother's account of the race massacre in virtually every book I've ever read about the race massacre. But until this new edition, I've never ever laid eyes on the book itself. And the book is an amazing piece of journalism. In the afterword, you describe how you first came to know your great-grandmother's book. Would you share that story?
I first heard about the race massacre when my father, William Bruner Jr., gave me the book in 1993-94. It was on a Christmas holiday break out to California to visit my family members who were still there. And he handed it to me. He took me into his room, closed the door. And, you know, it was a very different kind of experience with him because we were always around a lot of family, and he was a real gregarious type of person, real jovial, always, you know, in a up mood and laughing. This time he was very serious. He said, I have something to give you. I was completely confused and a little bit nervous, I have to say. He goes through his papers, and he pulls out this slim volume, a red hardcover book, and he says, this is a book that your great-grandmother wrote, and I want you to see if you can do anything with it. And he told me at that time, you're the matriarch of the family, and I want you to take care of this. I was 35 years old at the time, and he handed to me Events of the Tulsa Disaster by Mrs. Mary E. Jones Parrish. He said that was my grandmother. Your grandmother Florence's mother, and she wrote this book, and that was it. It didn't say very much more about it, and I took it and put it into my things, and when I returned to D.C. at the end of the holiday break, that's when I sat down, it must have been January of 1994, and read through it in one sitting. I was stunned. I had never heard of this event. I had never heard any rumblings of it within my own family, and I certainly had not heard that my great-grandmother, Mary Jones Parrish, was a journalist and writer. So on many fronts, I was flabbergasted, floored, stunned. I couldn't believe it.
It was an amazing achievement here in 1923 when the book was published. Is the story in a nutshell? A story at that time known by all parties that was suppressed, then distorted, if it was spoken about at all, for 60 years. You know, the 1980s is the next comprehensive account of the race massacre, or race riot as it was known at that time. And it took historians decades to piece together the story that's virtually all here in Miss Parrish's story. and the story she collected. It's really an amazing piece of journalism.
I would have to agree. And I am particularly proud, although, as with anything, for me, it's just an accident of birth that I am born into this family. But I have to say, without taking credit, that I am proud that a woman in my own family, an African-American woman, had the temerity, had the perseverance, had the presence of mind, and was as intrepid as she was to collect these stories, write down her own account, and to put together a comprehensive volume of these eyewitness recollections, you know, with such candor that you see expressed, with the exactitude of the language, and with the care that she took in, I would assume, having to collect monies in order to be able to privately publish this. And I base that on the ads that are in the back of the book that are reminiscent very much of what we used to see in church with an African-American church tradition, where we would have a program, and in order to finance the program, we sold ads to local businesses. Typically with church, it was funeral homes and hair salons and things of that nature. Here we have hair salons and other kinds of businesses that bought space in the book so that she would be able to bring the project to completion. Dr. William Kyle's, the novelty shop, Nails Brothers Shoe Shop, you know, any number of things. It is an interesting element of this book.
Yeah. We have to remember that by 1923, already the conspiracy of silence is starting to take place. By, you know, 1926, no mention is mentioned of the anniversary in the newspapers. And that will continue for decades to come. The story begins with your great-grandmother first visited Tulsa in 1918 and was immediately taken by the vibrancy of the community in Greenwood. And she moved here within a matter of months. Can you tell us what you know about her in those days? What's known about your great-grandmother?
Well, I have to say that I have to rely, just as any other person, on public sources, which is a great tragedy for me, because between my father and his mother, my grandmother Florence, who's mentioned in the book, I don't recall either of them ever mentioning her to me at all. And I can only imagine that they may have had private conversations, but it is a mystery to me as to why that was the case. From what I can understand, she lived into the early 1970s, and I had been born already. I was born in the 50s. So I can't offer any kind of explanation as to why her life was a mystery to me and my siblings, but I can offer only, you know, what others could find out for themselves. You know, her husband was a man by the name of Simon Parrish, and in the book, we don't see any mention of him. She had returned from Rochester, New York, you know, after that brief visit, and then came down to settle because her brothers were in the area. I'm not sure if they were actually in Tulsa, but there were any number of predominantly black towns that were spread throughout Oklahoma where black people were, you know, living their lives, normal lives, trying to be self-sufficient in the wake of centuries of enslavement and so forth, and the coming out of slavery and becoming educated and having really, you know, what I would describe as a strong sense from the government that this is what was needed, you know, not just for the black community, but for the country in terms of healing the wounds of, you know, human enslavement. So, you know, I think it was a time of great industry. She was an intrepid person, and certainly she describes in her foreword to the book that she was very much impressed, as you said, with the cooperation, the spirit of industry and achievement and ambition that she saw. And obviously, as she says, it appealed to her greatly. And beyond the financial, it was just the spirit of cooperation and self-sufficiency that I think appealed to her very much. And I can say, again, based on the text, where in the aftermath of the massacre, she's seeking an identity card and needs to be vouched for by some white person for whom she has worked. She says in the book clearly, I've never worked for any white person. This is a problem for me. I've always earned an independent living. So I think that certainly the spirit of independence, you know, in the Greenwood District of Tulsa appealed to her on a very personal and emotional and psychological level. That's what I can say.
If you were only to read her account of the events of May 31st and June 1st, it is it's quite an amazing story. But then, of course, she also gets eyewitness accounts as well and sets those down. But her own story, you know, it's like many of the citizens of Greenwood that night. They heard, you know, she was reading a book, engrossed in a book, and I guess your grandmother, Florence, was coming up to her and bothering her and saying, look, there's things going on out in the street. And she goes, go away, honey. I'm reading this book.
Exactly.
And finally she says, there are men with guns.
Right. You know, kid, you're getting on my nerves here. I haven't put you down to sleep yet, but, you know, let me stay up, look out the window, but let mommy alone. Certainly, you know, that just rings through my head over and over again. A small child looking out of their window and thinking, oh, what a pleasant night. You know, not in those words, obviously, but just, you know, being transfixed by whatever's going on outside in the street. But all of a sudden, there are these guns. There's trouble. Something's amiss. And she's alerting her mom. And as she says, as my great-grandmother says in the book, you know, Florence Mary was her constant companion. And she finally had to put her book down and go and see what was happening. Now, what strikes me most poignantly about this is, okay, there's this woman. She's sent her students home for the evening. She's there with her daughter. They're relaxing at home, what children should be doing. Ultimately, we learn in the book that on the other side, what they're teaching their children is, from the age of 10, it is okay to maraud and murder. This is, you know, I haven't heard anyone talk about what a travesty that is to teach children. And they said boys from the age of 10 years old.
Yes, that comes up.
Are out here participating in this mob activity. What, you know, how can we reconcile that with civilized behavior? The ultimate barbarity of enlisting children into this kind of, you know, this type of melee, this kind of activity, this kind of savagery. It's unbelievable.
That's some of the most poignant language. I think it comes up in some of the eyewitness accounts that your great-grandmother took down, in which they referred to the mob as almost this living being that sort of swarmed into Greenwood on that in the early hours of June 1st. And the feeling as men and women and children were being rounded up and sent to the convention center and then later to McNulty Field. You know, there were boys as young as 10 with guns and weapons spouting hateful things.
That's a horror.
Yeah. And what the eyewitness accounts say is, you know, I guess they expected that from the adult population, but I think the sense was that here is another generation being inculcated into this sort of behavior. You know, just it's being ingrained for another generation. I was really struck by that in some of the eyewitness accounts that your great-grandmother took down.
You know, it's unfathomable. You know, we think about current, you know, in the modern era, places around the world where child soldiers are conscripted into fights that they have no business in. I mean, and all that entails for future generations. And here we see this kind of thing, you know, laid out in graphic detail, that something as inhuman as, you know, conscripting children into this type of behavior. I mean, of course, it's horrifying enough that adults carry these things out, but for children to be sucked into something like this is horrible.
My guest today is Annalise Brunner, writer and editor, and the great-granddaughter of Mary Jones Parrish, who wrote the 1923 account of the events of the Tulsa disaster. It's now been published in a new edition from Trinity University Press, which also features forewords by the late John Hope Franklin and Scott Ellsworth, from their testimony in the various commissions on the race massacre over the years. And the book is titled The Nation Must Awake, My Witness to the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921. And it's really an amazing book. It's been used as source material for virtually every book written about the massacre, but it was only published in about about two dozen of volumes when it was first published. It's been a rare book, and now it's out in a new edition. And Annalise Bruner is my guest today. After your great-grandmother saw the men with guns, she eventually left and witnessed that sort of flight of terror that so many women and children embarked on that night. And she was on the road for hours, moving north, and everywhere she went, there was fear. There were people set up airplanes overhead, buzzing them, and her account is really quite amazing.
It is amazing, Rich, and you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned the airplanes because it really is emblematic of an energy for these people, a hostility, a hatred, just an absolute thirst for destruction of a community of people that was certainly, in existence well before the precipitating event is what I call, the gathering at the courthouse and all. But the point I want to make is psychologically how damaging it is to live under a system where you know that you are hated with that kind of fervor. And for people to now look back and think, people are exaggerating. It can't have been that bad. It really was that bad. Airplanes were deployed, machine guns. These are weapons of war, and certainly not something that even a despised population expects to be deployed against them,
right?
On American soil. So this is really pivotal. It is really a crucible.
It's taken, it's taken a long time for the accounts of airplanes dropping bombs, as it was referred to, and they were turpentine balls set aflame, and they helped cause fires. That was in dispute for so long, and yet here in this 1923 book, you see survivor after survivor mention the airplanes buzzing very low overhead, people with high-powered rifles in the plane, turpentine balls being dropped. This was known from the beginning, and yet it was. But the facts become in dispute. It was disputed for so long.
And in something I read, I think it probably was about 2000. An article from 2000. It was in the New York Times. And as I read through it, I saw, too, the word choice. Mm. According to local community lore,
you're right.
Planes were flying overhead. Are we to believe that these folks were caught up in a mass delusion, that they didn't know what airplanes were, or that they were in a conspiracy to make it sound worse than it was? I have to frankly say, we have to understand the ways that narratives are co-opted and changed and warped, even in service to, whatever the powerful and status-holding people say is the truth. And we are now, too, in an era where we are thinking, again, about the nature of truth, what is absolute and, objectively verifiable truth versus one person's truth versus another person's truth. I mean, these are, huge issues to grapple with. And we look at the Tulsa situation, and it is a discrete moment in time. And there are layers of reaction. There are layers of the narrative that emerges. There are layers of, defensiveness by interested parties in terms of how the story is perceived. So these are, there's a lot of instruction to take here, and I do hope that we all take it, because, the arc of history unrolls over a very long time. It unfolds slowly, and this, as you have described, certainly has a period of absolute suppression of this story, even within families, obviously within my own family. You know, I have grappled with understanding how could someone not tell me this? And then just one day, out of the blue, I'm 35 years old, and he hands me this book. So, you know, it is a complex tale, and our collective response to these kinds of atrocities, you know, continues to bear examination. And the way that I came to attention was Scott Ellsworth reached out to me after I wrote an article in the Lily about the January 6th insurrection, or as they're now calling it, 1-6. It's like 9/11, 1-6, you know, a pivotal historical event that will continue to be, you know, dissected and analyzed and all. But, you know, it's mind-boggling to me if people don't see the parallels. And the fact that we are living in a time where these energies and sentiments are resurging, and we need to address it.
Yeah. Two diametrically opposite versions of the truth. Of course, in the case of the race massacre, one was suppressed. Both were suppressed, but if any version escaped, it was the one that was sanitized of all wrongdoing. You know, what's really amazing about your great-grandmother was that not only did she write her own story, but she, you know, from the voice of these accounts, this must have been in the months right after the incident, where she's talking to people probably as they're at the Red Cross or the YMCA getting help to rebuild their lives. She's taking down their stories. You know, some of the stories are so amazing. C.L. Netherland, a barber who had a very successful business on Greenwood. He had, as he mentioned, he said, I had five chairs. I had, you know, blah, 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 blah. And now I have a stool in the middle of the street and I'm doing shaves and haircuts. These are really amazing stories. And they give us so much detail into what, as we were talking earlier about these stories that have been disputed. Here, this is not years later. This is not, you know, a conspiracy of people coming up with lore, as you refer to it. This is in the months afterwards, as they're still hurting and reeling. They're telling the story.
Mm-hmm. They're telling their stories. And, you know, what I have to say I'm so pleased to see is she was able to tell her story in her own voice. You know, we have a kind of a thing that we say these days, you know, giving voice to the voiceless. You know, average people are really not that voiceless. They just don't have a platform. Those are two different things. And what she did was permitted people to speak in their own voice. And I have to say, looking at what she did for a living, teaching the secretarial sciences, typewriting, Greg's shorthand, and those kinds of things, probably office management, things that helped bright women who in those days may have been constrained in terms of career opportunities. That's what a lot of smart women and industrious women did. They worked as secretaries. So, you know, it was not a frowned upon profession. It was a hallowed profession, if you will, because it allowed women to be independent and to, you know, have a dignified life. So I'm sure that she employed her skills as a shorthand master. And I have no doubt that she took down those words verbatim and that she then transcribed them on her, you know, one of her machines. Mm. So this is also, in addition to her skill as a reporter, it also speaks to the fact that before the advent of the dictaphone, you know, she was using, you know, putting pen to paper and capturing what people were saying very accurately, I would dare to say, because she was a skilled shorthand practitioner. So I think we can have a lot of confidence in how accurately she captured what the other folks were saying.
It is a remarkable account, and I'm so happy to see it out in a new volume where more people can read this really it's the first document about this terrible event in Tulsa in 1921. It was originally titled The Events of the Tulsa Disaster. It's now on a new volume titled The Nation Must Awake, My Witness to the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 by Mary E. Jones Parrish. My guest today is Annalisa Bruner, who's a writer and editor and is the great-granddaughter of Mary Jones Parrish. You're going to be speaking at the symposium coming up, the John Hope Franklin Symposium. What are you going to be sharing with folks at the symposium?
Well, what I'll be talking about is some of the things that I've spoken with you about, how this book came to my attention. And when I say book, I use it almost interchangeably with the massacre itself, because before I read the book, although I lived in a family of direct descendants from a Mary Jones Parrish, I had never heard of this. And not just of Mary Jones Parrish, I did know my grandmother Florence out in California, but I never knew her to mention this in my presence. And what I'll be talking about is trauma and how we as a nation heal from it, how individuals are affected and how so many are unhealed, and the things that have to happen around, a true reconciliation within society and within the self. And a little bit about framing it in terms of abusive systems that people might, in which people might find themselves as individuals, a family situation that's abusive, a relationship situation that's abusive, so that people can identify with how some of these survivors might have felt in the aftermath and how that gets passed down through families, through the generations. That's really one of the main themes that I'll be talking about there, and it's something that I addressed in my article that I wrote about 1/6, and how some of this tragedy is not just a discrete and compartmentalized one-time event. It's something that continues to resonate, and truth is part of the healing. And so that's why I really focus on that quite a bit in what we've talked about here today, and it is also something that I will continue to explore in what I'm talking about during my talk at the symposium.
Annalisa, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to put this story forward. Thank you.
Annalisa Bruner speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's the great-granddaughter of Mary Jones Parrish, who wrote of her experience surviving the Tulsa Race Massacre and collected the experience of other Greenwood survivors in her book, Events of the Tulsa Disaster. The book is now available in a new edition titled The Nation Must Awake, My Witness to the Tulsa Race Massacre. It's published by Trinity University Press. Bruner will be speaking about the book Tuesday evening, May 25th at 7 o'clock in a virtual event at Magic City Books, and she'll be a participant the following day in the John Hope Franklin Center's Reconciliation Symposium. That will take place Wednesday at 4. You can learn more about that at jhfnationalsymposium.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.